Great to have you with us on the Ideas Network. Larry Mueller here. To start the show today, we're going to take a look at the amphibians and reptiles that call Wisconsin home. Why are we doing that? Well, our two guests are the authors of an amazing new reference book, and its title is Amphibians and Reptiles of Wisconsin. With us are Joshua Kapfer, a certified wildlife biologist, a professor in the Department of Biological Sciences at the University of Wisconsin-Whitewater. Josh, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Larry. I'm really happy to be here.
With us as well, the other editor and author, Donald Brown, also a certified wildlife biologist and a research assistant professor of wildlife resources in the School of Natural Resources at West Virginia University. And Donald, good to have you with us as well.
Thank you. Slight correction. I'm now a research ecologist with the Forest Service in Washington State.
Okay. I'll try to remember that, but
yeah, no worries.
I'll tell you what, it's great to have both of you here. And as we talk with these two, I hope you'll join in as you listen in with your own questions. Do you have a favorite amphibian or reptile? What questions do you have about them? Number to call is 800-642-1234. It's 800-642-1234. Or you could send an email to ideas@wpr.org. ideas@wpr.org. You know what? Before we start talking about the book, you both are certified wildlife biologists. What does it mean to be a certified wildlife biologist? Donald, do you want to take that?
Sure. So the Wildlife Society is sort of our official society for wildlife research and management. And they initiated a certification program, which includes X number of classes in different topics, as well as experience with wildlife research and management. And so if you have accumulated enough learning and experience, then you can apply to be certified as a certified wildlife biologist.
Well, I wondered about it, and I wasn't quite sure, and I was pretty sure many of our listeners might not be either, so I'm glad I asked that question. Well, I carried your book, my office from my parking lot to Wisconsin Public Radio. It's a mile walk, so I carried the book. It's a big book, but it is an amazing book about these species, and have you considered the fact that 100 years from now, or maybe even 200 years from now, you are both going to be cited by others who write about the amphibians and reptiles of Wisconsin? There's no way that you wouldn't be. Josh,
well,
what do you
think? Tried to make a resource that we thought would be lasting, but mostly our goal was to make it useful. And so hopefully that continues to be the case.
So to my mind, it is very useful. And I'm certainly not any expert at all. I'm interested in amphibians and reptiles. And as I read through the book, and I haven't read, I got to tell you right now, I haven't read all 1,173 pages of the book, but I picked parts of the book, and I was amazed at the clear, crisp writing that you have in it. How long did it take you to? Well, first, how did the two of you happen to come together to put this together?
Yeah, I can take that if you want, Josh.
Yeah, go ahead, Donald.
So it's an interesting story. The book was actually the seed of the book was born in Texas. I was a PhD student at Texas State University, and I was getting ready to transition to my postdoc with University of Wisconsin-Madison. And I was thinking, well, I'm moving to Wisconsin, so I should probably get a herps book for Wisconsin. And that led me to realize there isn't really a robust herps book in Wisconsin at all at that time. And at the same time, I was reading the new issue of Herpetological Review, and there was a Wisconsin County record from Eric Wild in that issue. And so I emailed Eric Wilde and he connected me to Josh. And then it just moved from there.
And how many, Josh, how many years have you been working on this?
I think we determined that it, from start to finish, it was 9 years.
Well, I can believe that. I can definitely believe that. And maybe just, Josh, maybe you can describe in sort of in general how your book is put together.
Sure. So, you know, obviously we wanted this book to be something that was useful. So we thought to ourselves, you know, what would we have found useful when we were graduate students, academics, but also, you know, state and federal regulators, consultants, what would be useful in a book like this? And so we wanted to make sure that it was a robust scientific document in that regard. But we also wanted to make sure that it was something that the average person just interested in natural resources could find interesting things to read in. So we organize things so that there is a clear sort of robustness to it, organized by various ecological, biological criteria sections. But we also try and, you know, start off each species account with a summary of that organism so that an individual that doesn't want to go into all that depth can just read that paragraph and get what they need. We included introductory chapters that we thought would be applicable to a wider variety of people. Information on Wisconsin plant communities. Obviously, we're not botanists, but that, you know, how they relate to amphibians and reptiles, information on historical figures in Wisconsin herpetology, and so on.
I thought it was great. You know, peppered through the book are natural history boxes, you call them. And I really enjoyed reading those. They sometimes put a kind of a personal bent to what you're talking about. Donald, I remembered one from you. I think you wrote about lizards and sex. So describe that just to give a flavor.
I did my undergraduate degree at University of Minnesota, and at the time there were no professors there working on amphibians and reptiles, so I wasn't really introduced to amphibians and reptiles at that point very much. But when I got to Texas, I really got involved with amphibians and reptiles, and that ended up being the focus of my master's and PhD work. Anyway, so I was a sort of a budding herpetologist at that time. So there's so many things I did not know. And the first time I saw six-line race runners, one dragging the other around and biting it on its side, I thought there was a war going on in front of me. And my advisor was like, no, they're just mating. So that was very exciting for me at the time.
I love that. And then sort of on the other end, there's, let me think. Well, one example was rattlesnake decline. It was another one of your, yes. If I'm not mistaken, Josh.
Absolutely, yeah. Well, we there's a couple of natural history boxes that were devoted to rattlesnake decline. There's one specifically in the Massasauga account about the Massasauga in Wisconsin, but we also, in our introduction to conservation and management chapter, include a detailed account of how, to the best of our knowledge and the best of available information, how the rattlesnake bounty impacted rattlesnakes in the state, because we had an active bounty on rattlesnakes in Wisconsin until just a couple decades ago. We really wanted those natural, you know, the first book on amphibians and reptiles, or I'm sorry, I shouldn't say the first, the one prior to ours that sort of covered all aspects of ecology for those organisms was a book by Richard Carl Vogt. And that came out in 81. And it's, you know, well-loved by everybody who studies amphibians and reptiles. And one of the reasons why that book is so beloved is because he included anecdotal stories and like you said, Larry, personal touches about his interactions with those organisms. So we wanted to, you know, sort of highlight that while also still making it a robust scientific sort of treatise. So we separated them out in these natural history boxes that you reference. And they're one of my favorite features of the book, to be honest with you.
Yeah, I really enjoy them. And, you know, every one of our phone lines is filled. So maybe we should take some calls here. Chris in Black Creek, what's on your mind?
Oh, my gosh, Larry. Thank you so much. Okay, so when I was a kid, and it was a little bit west of Appleton, two times in my life when I was young, I had to use two hands to pick up these giant toads. I did a little research on them. I can't remember the name of the toad, but they were like 4 pounds, and they actually disappeared. I haven't seen one ever since I was a kid. And then when I was young, I had three painted turtles. I cut a 55-gallon drum barrel long ways, put it in the ground, made a fence around it in a little beach for them, and I fed them their worms and stuff. And, you know, Wisconsin, all of a sudden, bam, it froze. And my turtles were frozen in the bottom of that barrel, and only like a foot or so of water in the bottom of that barrel. Well, the next spring, I'll be darned, two of them lived. So they froze solid.
And so they froze solid, and they were living. Well, you guys know anything about the giant toad that Chris is talking about, and maybe a comment on the turtle? Donald, do you want to take that?
Yeah, I'll take the toad comment. That's a big, that's a heavy animal, 4 pounds. if it truly was 4 pounds, I think we're probably talking about a large bullfrog, would be my guess. Josh, do you agree with that?
Yeah, if it wasn't actually a toad, then it seems more likely to be a bullfrog. But
yeah, so bullfrogs can get pretty big. Yeah. And if they've got a full belly or they're full of eggs, they're pretty massive. I once filled the bottom of a 5-gallon bucket with a large female bullfrog.
They also, in the book, we have a natural history box about gigantic, quote-unquote gigantic toads. That was co-written by Andrew Badgey of the Wisconsin DNR. Well, it was written by Andrew and used data provided to him by Charles Long out of UW-Stevens Point. And Charles had been looking into these giant toads, you know, and he had seen all of these toads along the Lake Michigan Islands in the 70s. And so, you know, it's possible that there's some sort of relationship there, I guess, but 4 pounds is a massive, massive animal. But yeah, so, really cool.
And so then our caller had some painted turtles that kind of froze over winter.
Yeah.
But then comment on that.
Well, turtles are really incredible in their ability to survive cold conditions, especially those that live in sort of shallow aquatic habitats that potentially get a little more frozen than a river or a lake or something like that. And so painted turtles have there's a couple of things about painted turtles. They can engage in this, what is called supercooling, where as long as ice crystals don't form in the fluids within their body, they won't freeze. And they have real thick epidermis, right? A thick skin that doesn't allow ice crystals to penetrate that easily. So things like painted turtles can resist freezing. In fact, some hatchlings, females will lay eggs occasionally twice a year, once in the spring and then once in the fall. And the ones that are laid in the fall, they usually hatch, but they stay in the nest for the winter and come out in the spring. So occasionally you'll see these tiny, tiny hatchling turtles in the spring. And those turtles had, you know, resisted freezing by supercooling.
That's really interesting. Thanks for that call. Let's go to Tom in La Crescent, Minnesota. Tom, hello.
Hey, I got a question. I live on a Mississippi River, and on Lock and Dam number 6, it is between Trempealeau, Wisconsin, and the Minnesota side. There's the lock and dam, and then there's a long dike that goes across, you know, full of sand and rock. One day the boys were down there, and they were playing down there, and they come home with four lizards. They're about 4 inches long, And I didn't even know there were lizards up here until that day. And I'm just curious what you can tell me about those.
What do they look like?
I think he talks about that six-banded racer. Or somebody did.
Six-line racer.
That's what they look like.
Six-line racer under.
Yeah.
Donald, go ahead and comment on those.
I'll let Josh take this one, actually.
Okay, Josh
is going to be more familiar with the lizard fauna in that area.
So the up on the – there are – along the Mississippi and Wisconsin river valleys, reports of or county records for the six-lined race runner that Donald mentioned before. And so usually they're a prairie species, sand prairie, but I have seen them along bluff habitats in, you know, rocky sort of goat prairies, as they're sometimes called. And so it's possible that, you know, they get down along those dikes if those dikes are dry enough and you know, sort of appear or behave like a sand prairie. We actually have, four species of lizards in Wisconsin. We have the six-lined race runner, the five-lined skink, the slender glass lizard, which is a legless lizard, and the northern prairie skink. We don't have many lizards, but we have those four.
Yeah. Tom, thank you again for calling. Marcus in Milwaukee, on to you. Hi, Marcus.
Hey, Larry. So I guess my question for your guests is, from their research, what have they uncovered being the largest snake that's ever lived in Wisconsin? I mean, I'm talking, they can go all the way back to like Paleozoic, Precambrian, Jurassic, Triassic, wherever.
Josh, let's go to you.
Well, going all the way back to the Paleozoic, I apologize. I don't know that particularly well, but currently in the state and probably, you know, our recent, prehistory, the largest species has been the gopher snake, which is sometimes called a bull snake. The subspecies is the bull snake of the gopher snake. And they, you know, historic reports are, you know, 7 feet. Now, I've never seen one that big, and I did my PhD research on gopher snakes. I've seen them, however, over 5 feet, and that's an impressive animal. So that's our largest one. Those are usually sequestered to the Wisconsin and Mississippi River valleys. Again, they need that bluff habitat to overwinter in to get below the frost line, and they need prairie habit and savanna habitat to spend the rest of the year in. And there's an abundance of that over there.
Thanks very much, Marcus, for that question. Appreciate it. Talking today with Josh Kapfer. Joshua Kapfer is certified wildlife biologist, professor in the Department of Biological Sciences at UW-Whitewater. Donald Brown is a certified wildlife biologist and research. He's with the U.S. Forest Service now. Let's put it that way. Got it. And was a former, in the School of Natural Resources at West Virginia University. And their book, this is a fantastic book, Amphibians and Reptiles of Wisconsin. Join in with your questions, 800-642-1234, or email to ideas@wpr.org. Jill Nadeau, our producer today, Trina LaSousa, our engineer. I'm Larry Mueller for the Ideas Network. Taking a look at the book Amphibians and Reptiles of Wisconsin and talking about those amphibians and reptiles with our two guests today who authored the book Amphibians and Reptiles of Wisconsin, Joshua Kapfer and Donald Brown. It's great to have both of them with us today. And again, you can join in 800-642-1234. Email to ideas@wpr.org. Bruce in Kenosha County has a question for you guys. Let's go there. Hi, Bruce.
Hi. We were on a walk in the woods yesterday, and my wife likes to stop and look and listen. Now, I thought it was going to be birds and deer tracks and things like that. No, well, what we heard was a frog, a high-pitched little and while we stopped there, she spotted a gardener snake. Did I pronounce that right? Stunning itself.
Oh, so very, very cool. It sounds like you may have been hearing maybe a spring peeper, Josh?
Yeah, spring peeper, or, you know, it could have been a chorus frog.
Oh, yeah.
Sometimes they'll do that trilling noise a little bit when they're defensive, but either one of those would be, without having actually heard it myself, one of those two, I'd guess. And the snake was likely a garter snake, the probably the common garter snake. And so that sometimes they're called gardener snakes by people, but the name garter snake comes from the sort of pattern that those snakes have, where they have these long bands, black bands that run down the body, interspersed by yellow sort of stripes. And, you know, back before the advent of elastic, people held up socks and et cetera with garters. And so whoever gave the common name to that snake thought it looked like it had garters on, and that's where that name comes from.
Very interesting. Oh, Bruce, thanks again. Doc in Two Harbors, Minnesota, will go to you.
Say good morning.
Good morning.
I live on the north shore of Lake Superior in Minnesota. But what I wanted to get at is that I'm very concerned about the lake, but there are other, you know, critters that I see because I walk the beaches and so on, that that are amphibians and reptiles and so on. I just wanted your input as to what is there. I hope there isn't any threat to them is what I'm trying to get at. So if you could just talk about that maybe a little bit.
Yeah, that's a good. I'm glad you brought that up, Doc, because unfortunately there are a number of threats, I guess we could say, to our amphibians and reptiles in the state. Maybe Donald, do you want to start, and then we can go to Josh too?
Sure. Yes, there are many threats. I would say that being where you're located, you have less threats than a lot of areas. Where Josh is in southern Wisconsin certainly has more threats going on. But one threat that all of us are dealing with is climate change. So climate change is a huge threat, and we throw this word around, climate change. Like, what does that mean? Well, one of the big things for amphibians and reptiles is that they are ectothermic. So they are relying on external energy. And one thing that climate change does is it's changing the temperature patterns as well as seasonality shifts, and the species are responding to those shifts. And so there are a number of things that can happen with that. For many of our turtles, they have what's called temperature-dependent sex determination, which means the temperatures at which the eggs are incubating determines the sex of the animal that comes out of the nest. And so there are a lot of biological aspects that are really intimately tied to temperature regimes. Another thing is prey resources, right? So if prey are changing with the changing climate, then the amphibians and reptiles will also be having to follow those changes. And so you can get what's called a phenotypic or a phenological mismatch between those things that can be an issue.
Yeah.
So I'll stop talking and let Josh go.
Okay.
So the... Yeah, as Donald had mentioned, there's a large number of threats facing amphibians and reptiles today. And Donald and Christine Ribbick from UW-Madison wrote a great chapter at the beginning of the book about the impacts of climate change on amphibians and reptiles in the state. And then we have this chapter on conservation and management. And the number one reason why all species go extinct is habitat loss, habitat destruction, degradation, fragmentation. But there's, you know, pollution, there are diseases, emerging infectious diseases, there are invasive species, over-harvesting, and you wouldn't think of over-harvesting as being an issue for amphibians and reptiles because they're not like game fish or game species like white-tailed deer, but just about everybody probably that's over the age of 30 dissected frogs in their science class, and those are primarily wild-caught. So there was a lot of individuals being harvested for things like biological supply companies. So yeah, amphibians and reptiles face a whole host of challenges, like Donald mentioned.
Yeah, a lot of them, having done a lot of bike riding along the roads, I've seen a number of turtles, for example, or whatever, killed by cars. Mm-hmm. And
yeah, that's a huge problem, especially when... Salamanders as well, amphibians. You think about organisms that have, you know, what we would consider habitat split, where they need two different habitats to meet their annual life history needs, right? They need uplands to spend most of the year, but they need wetlands to breed amphibians are a great example. So when they have to cross, if a barrier is erected between those two, it becomes hugely problematic.
Yeah, absolutely. Tom in Ocado has a comment for us. Let's go there. Hi, Tom.
Hi there. Talking about salamanders, spotted and blue spotted. Dick Voigt's book back then listed them both as rare. And when the Bureau of Endangered Resources came into being, one was spotted were classified as endangered and blue spotted were classified as threatened. And it wasn't until the proposed Exxon mine site, where Dames and Moore biologists had a hell of a surprise, because suddenly they were running over salamanders in their road tracks. And the next spring they went out and they surveyed all the way up into the UP and many ephemeral ponds in northeastern Wisconsin, and they found them to be abundant. And the status of that those two species were totally changed because of the proposed mine site by Exxon at Crandon.
Interesting. Well, Josh, you're probably closest to this comment. Would you comment?
Yeah, I will, but I'll let Donald. He's got good insight into this. I'll let him start.
Okay.
Yeah, I just want to make a broader comment, and this really applies to every state wildlife management agency. We are learning all the time. And so at any given point in time, the managers have to use their best available science. And so when the science is lacking, then they're making their best choice based on what they know. And so in a lot of cases, we do end up learning a lot more about specific species, and then we change their status based on that new information.
Tom, thank you very much for calling. Appreciate your call. Share an email to say thank you for your lovely, huge book. Her kids are endlessly entertained by the pictures and the notes. That's kind of nice to hear, isn't it?
Absolutely. That's exactly what we want to hear, is input from people that find the book enjoyable and useful. That's why we did it.
I love that. And I would note that your appendix and glossary is almost 300 pages, I think. It's just sort of to relate back to that. But I did want to also mention the wonderful work done with the photography, and the diagrams and photos and stuff are absolutely fantastic. How did you put it all? I mean, I imagine those photos and so forth came from a variety of sources or not, Donald?
So Eric Wild did all of the illustrations for the book. And Eric has a long history in Wisconsin. He was a professor at UW-Stevens Point. He's currently an adjunct professor there. And he is also a biological illustrator. So this was an opportunity for us to bring somebody on board that is a really good illustrator, but also intimately connected to Wisconsin and a herpetologist. So it worked out perfectly in that sense. And then the photography, many, many of the contributors to the book also contributed their photographs. And then many other people that actually didn't write in the book at all also contributed photographs to the book. So, yes, many dozens of people contributed photos.
That really helps the book a lot, I think. I mean, just to be able to see those photos of the amphibians and reptiles and the rest of it really adds a lot to this book. Go ahead, Josh.
I'm sorry, Larry, I didn't interrupt.
No, go ahead.
I think it's something that I want to take a second to mention, is that we've kind of been talking like it's our book, but there were over 50 contributing authors on this book. Donald and I edited it, and we wrote large portions of it too, but I mean, it was a group effort. We made sure that, or we wanted to make sure that we had people with a wide variety of experiences, but also that had experience in Wisconsin. We wanted to make sure that we had people with expertise in these organisms writing the accounts. And so we felt very strongly. And one of the aspects of the book that I'm very happy about is that so many people can have a sense of ownership over it.
Yeah, it's really wonderful. Don and Grassette we'll go to you next. Don, hi.
Hello. Yes, I have a question about turtles. I've seen turtles, young turtles, hatch real early in March when it was really cold. And I was wondering, do the turtles lay their eggs in the fall and those eggs survive through the winter and hatch so early?
Yeah, that's we had just kind of talked about that a second ago. The painted turtles are one of those that do what are called double clutching, and that means they will have sometimes a clutch of eggs in the spring, and then they will have another clutch of eggs in the fall. And that clutch of eggs that is laid in the fall, the hatchlings will hatch, but they'll stay in the nest over the winter. So yeah, every once in a while you see that, where you see these tiny little hatchling painted turtles coming out to head to the wetland in the spring.
Oh, Don, thank you. Ann in Amory, will go to you. Hi, Ann.
Hi, can you hear me?
Yes, go ahead.
Good. I have a funny story to tell you. We were farming and had I had to go out to the barnyard and throw hay to the cows. And I went to get my rubber boots on. This was about in the 1980s. And I went to get my rubber boots on, which were in the garage. And I put my foot into one of the boots. And by George, there was a salamander in there. What a surprise that was.
That would get your attention. Salamander. And again, how many salamanders do we have in the state, Josh?
We have 7, Donald, or do we have 11? Isn't that terrible?
It's harder than people think to come up with these numbers right off the top of our head.
Yeah.
Well, there's
we have 7 salamanders.
Seven salamanders, species of salamander in the state. And you know, sometimes it's, you mentioned one, I think, that has no legs. So sometimes it may be difficult for people to decide if we're looking at a snake or we're looking at a salamander, perhaps.
Well, and that one's actually a lizard, so even more confusing.
Yeah. even more confusing. Okay. But you do a really nice job of explaining and talking about those differences throughout the book.
Thank you.
Mike wondered, we talked about how turtles manage to survive the winter, but Mike wonders about frogs. What happens to frogs in the winter?
Well, it depends on the species. There are some species of frog that overwinter underwater, and they'll sort of get to an area where the water won't freeze. It's well oxygenated. They can absorb oxygen through their skin for the winter. Their metabolism slows down so much because they are ectothermic or cold-blooded that their metabolic needs are so low that they have minimal energy requirements. So they can survive the winter with just that minimal oxygen being absorbed through the skin. There are some species, however, that overwinter in the sort of water interface. So the cricket frog is one. It's our only endangered frog, where it overwinters in crayfish burrows right at the interface between water and land. So it kind of follows the water level up and down a little bit in these crayfish burrows. So it can't be fully submerged in the winter, but it also can't be frozen. And then there are some species that overwinter on land that have the ability to resist freezing in the winter by the production of a glycogen-based antifreeze that resists ice crystals from forming within their cells.
That is really, really cool. By the way, your book, I hope it finds its way to every school.
Yeah, agreed. I've often said to people is that what's most important to me is that everybody has access to it, right? That everybody has access to it and get the information if they want it. So whether that's from a library, from a school, etc., I just want to make sure that that information is available. And in fact, recently I ran into a teacher who had taken a field herpetology class with me many years ago, and he had bought four copies of the book, and he donated them. He kept one for himself, and then he donated the other ones to schools in the Milton area. So really cool, you know, that, you know, make sure that, and the local library as well. So,
well, I got to tell you, I'm surprised at how inexpensive the book is when compared to the volume and the information and the photos and everything else that's in that book. It amazes me that it's as cheap as it is, Donald.
Yeah, so one of the things that we were really adamant about from day one was that the photographs would be in full color. So you see, you get a lot of books where the photographs are printed in black and white because it's cheaper to do it that way. But that process, of course, is much more expensive to print the books. And so Josh, both UW Press and Josh, went on some pretty substantial missions to fundraise for the book. And collectively, they fundraised over $20,000, which allowed us to basically cut the book cost in half. And our goal being, like Josh said, we wanted the book to be as inexpensive as possible, because that way the most people possible can actually buy it.
Yeah, well, you've certainly done that, and you've come up with an absolutely wonderful book. Do you have do you have a favorite species in your book? Donald, what's yours?
Yeah, so mine is definitely the wood turtle. I have been in love with wood turtles since 2015 when I went to Wisconsin and started working on them, and I have never stopped. To this day, three of my current grad students at West Virginia University are working on wood turtles right now.
Man, Josh, what about you?
Well, it's hard for me not to say that the species I love the most is the gopher snake or the bull snake, which is what I did my PhD on. But I do have a soft spot for the timber rattlesnake too.
Well, it has been a real pleasure. Would you guys come back and be with us again? I'd love to have you back.
Absolutely.
To talk some more, and I hope you sell a million copies. Amphibians and Reptiles of Wisconsin is the title of the book, and it's University of Wisconsin Press, correct?
Yep.
And you are going to find a wealth of information on this book, and when you buy it, you're going to remember that this book is going to be cited for the next 100, 200 years. I'm convinced of that. It is the last word, at least currently, on the amphibians and reptiles of Wisconsin. Josh, Donald, thank you so much for taking time to be with us today. I really appreciate it.
Thank you very much, Larry.
Yeah, it's been a real pleasure. Yeah, been a real pleasure. Josh Kapfer, certified wildlife biologist, as is Donald Brown, certified wildlife biologists, and their book, Amphibians and Reptiles of Wisconsin. Take a look at the book. You're going to be amazed at what you see, for sure. Well, you're also going to be amazed at the number of things and field trips that you can do here in Wisconsin over the next summer, the next year. I'll tell you what, the Natural Resources Foundation folks are with us to talk about, I think there's 260 field trips, and you can sign up for them. We'll talk about that next. I'm Larry Mueller for the Ideas Network.